ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, US Congress votes in favour of releasing the Epstein files. All eyes now on Donald Trump's next move. Also, New South Wales to introduce laws cracking down on neo-Nazism. And as the cost of living makes it harder to get children playing sport, charities are looking for solutions.
We know that over $4 million of brand new goods go to waste in Australia every year, and that includes play essentials. And it's quite criminal that it's going to waste before having a first life in the hands of people in need.
In the United States, it's expected the president will soon sign off on legislation to force the release of the Epstein files, the Justice Department documents on the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Republican-controlled US Congress has voted almost unanimously to release the files. Donald Trump opposed the move for months until abruptly changing his position earlier this week and backing the documents' release. Mr. Trump and Epstein partied together in the 90s and early 2000s until the future president cut ties with the financier. But the relationship continues to threaten the president's standing and is seeing him lose the backing of many in his Make America Great Again movement. Nick Grimm prepared this report.
This US TV commercial shows a series of women holding photos of themselves as teenage girls.
I was 14 years old.
I was 16 years old.
I was 16.
17.
14 years old.
Produced by World Without Exploitation, an organisation fighting human trafficking, it's appeared on American television this week.
This is me.
This was me.
This is me
when I met Jeffrey Epstein.
This is me when I met Jeffrey Epstein.
It's just one part of the push to release all files related to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who died in prison in 2019.
There are about 1,000 of us.
The yeas are 427, the nays are one.
Today, that campaign resulted in the US Congress voting almost unanimously to make public tens of thousands of pages of documents gathered as part of the investigation, first through the House of Representatives, before being greenlit in the Senate, with Democrats and Republicans uniting to support the bill.
Is there an objection? Without objection, so ordered.
The Senate has now passed the Epstein bill as soon as it comes over from the House.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer describing it as a win for open government.
This isn't about Democrats versus Republicans or about Congress versus the president. This is about giving the American people the transparency they've been crying for.
As many of us who are looking at our phones know that the Senate has passed the bill under unanimous consent.
It's an outcome the Trump administration spent months fighting to prevent before the US president this week backflipped, promising he won't use his executive power to veto the bill when it hits his desk. It's been welcomed by those who identify themselves as survivors of abuse at the hands of Jeffrey Epstein and others, like Annie Farmer, who paid tribute to another prominent accuser, Virginia Roberts Giuffre, who died by suicide at her home near Perth earlier this year.
And so I am thinking about so many women as I am here today. And most of all, you know, I am thinking about Virginia Roberts Giuffre. We would not be here without her. There is no doubt in my mind about that.
It's an issue that's long threatened to engulf the Trump administration, with many Americans who supported the president's return to the White House now believing there's been a cover-up of Epstein's ties to the rich and powerful. Television screens have been repeatedly showing images of Donald Trump partying with the disgraced financier in the 1990s and early 2000s. The coverage and persistent questions clearly rankling the president, last week dismissing a Bloomberg reporter's inquiry on board Air Force One, telling her to
quiet piggy.
Then today, the president turned on another White House journalist who'd asked why he hadn't ordered the release of the files before now.
You're a terrible person and a terrible reporter. As far as the Epstein files is,
I have nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein. I threw him out of my club many years ago because I thought he was a sick pervert.
The US president going on to argue the reporter's employer, the American ABC network, should lose its license for broadcasting fake news. But the question remains, why didn't Mr. Trump release the files sooner? Matt Klink is a Republican political strategist.
I don't know if he's protecting people or what, but from a strictly crisis communications perspective, what he should have done is throw the doors open and release everything that he possibly can, obviously protecting the anonymity of victims and not releasing grand jury testimony, which is not releasable. I don't know why he did it. Only Donald Trump knows why he decided to hold it. But the truth will set you free. Throw all this stuff out there. He should have done this immediately. And that's what his supporters expected him to do. Because, I mean, look, he's lived up to so many of his campaign promises. And he was backpedaling on this. And I think he realized that this was an unforced error on his part. And this is not going to help Republicans win in 2026, but it could certainly hurt them in 2026 if they continue to hide and not release the files.
That's Republican strategist Matt Klink, Nick Grimm reporting. And if you need help after hearing this story, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's the National Sexual Violence Helpline. The number is 1-800-737-732. Staying in the US, and Donald Trump has fiercely defended Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, insisting he wasn't involved in the 2018 killing of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Mr. Trump's statement is a direct contradiction of American intelligence, which concluded the Crown Prince approved the killing of the reporter. The president's comments have been fiercely condemned by those close to Mr. Khashoggi, but the controversy hasn't deterred Mr. Trump from announcing a strengthening of the military ties between the US and Saudi Arabia. Luke Radford reports.
In 2018, US-based Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but he never came back out because he was murdered and dismembered by a group of Saudi agents waiting inside. While eight people were ultimately convicted in connection to the crime by Saudi authorities, US intelligence has long stated that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation to capture or kill the reporter. Today, US President Donald Trump welcomed the Crown Prince to the White House for his first official visit in more than 7 years. And while discussions began around business and security deals, it wasn't long before the question of Jamal Khashoggi's murder was raised.
Your Royal Highness, the US intelligence concluded that you orchestrated the brutal murder of a journalist. 9/11 families are furious that you are here in the Oval Office. Why should Americans trust
who
you?
Who are you with?
I'm with ABC News, sir.
You're with who?
ABC News, sir.
Fake news. ABC fake news. One of the worst in the business. But I'll answer your question.
The president stepping in to defend the Crown Prince, contradicting his own intelligence service by claiming the prince had no knowledge of the crime.
You're mentioning somebody that was extremely controversial. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that.
And despite the president taking the question, the Crown Prince also responding.
The journalist, it's really painful to hear anyone that been losing his life for, you know, no real purpose or nothing illegal way. And it's been painful for us in Saudi Arabia. We've did all the right steps of investigation, etc., in Saudi Arabia. And we've improved our system to be sure that nothing happened like that. And it's painful and it's a huge mistake. And we are doing our best that this doesn't happen again.
Journalist Jamal Khashoggi was at one point a Saudi royal insider, but later went into self-imposed exile in the US after becoming a critic of the Saudi leadership. While President Trump has declared the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman innocent of his murder, most observers disagree. The president's comments were rebuked by Jamal Khashoggi's widow, Hanan.
His justification for the crime upset me in sense. Nothing to justify just a horrible crime, kidnapping, torture, and killing and dismantle a body, because he's controversial or he's unliked by someone.
But Hanan Khashoggi took a different tone when asked about the Crown Prince's visit to the White House.
I did have a mixed feeling I feel very sore because I wish Jamal still alive and safe, and he's here to receive him, because Jamal believed in him a lot. And Jamal, in fact, in 2018, in the first visit of the Crown Prince to US, Jamal was waiting for an invitation from US, from the Crown Prince, to share with him his opinion and his vision and to rectify any misinformation being told to the Crown Prince.
Jamal Khashoggi's former colleague at the Washington Post, Jason Rezaian, was far more blunt. He says it was beneath the office of the US president to invite the Crown Prince, let alone defend him.
If you recall, the question was posed to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, not to President Trump. So I think it was unfortunate, reprehensible, and I had sort of predicted that this would be the way that it went. Really not glory being shrouded on the office of the US president today.
Mr. Rezaian also criticized the increased cooperation between the two nations.
There was a lot of talk today about massive Saudi investment into American infrastructure, but also, you know, there's a big arms deal involved. And there is discussion that this man and people around him would like to buy major American media companies. I think that should be very chilling and horrifying to Americans.
Despite criticism of his defense of the prince, President Trump is pressing ahead, announcing that Saudi Arabia will be formally designated as a major non-NATO ally. In exchange, the kingdom has pledged to increase its total investment in the United States to almost $1 trillion US dollars.
Luke Radford. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The New South Wales government has announced it'll toughen laws to combat public displays of Nazi ideology. The decision comes less than 2 weeks after a group of neo-Nazis held a rally outside state parliament. Tanya Dendrinos prepared this report.
On November 8, around 60 people from the National Socialist Network gathered outside New South Wales Parliament, dressed in black with a banner that read, "Abolish the Jewish Lobby." They chanted, "Blood and Honour," a slogan associated with the Hitler Youth. It prompted government action. Chris Minns is the New South Wales Premier.
I and the Attorney General acknowledges that we would be at the forefront of changes to the law in relation to hate speech in Australia. Now, we don't apologise for that. We think that that's important to send a clear and unambiguous message that Nazis aren't welcome.
The Premier's referring to amendments his government announced today designed to give police and courts greater power to combat Nazism and racial hatred.
I want to make sure and I want to be clear that it stands up to constitutional scrutiny in the High Court. Because I think we'd be in a worse position if we introduce the legislation inside 7 days, we rushed it through Parliament, and then it gets knocked over in the court. The reason we're sending it to a committee is so that we can seek and gather information from constitutional experts at universities and in the law, and we make sure that we get it right.
The state government says the Crimes Act 1900 will be amended to ban conduct which indicates support for Nazi ideology by invoking imagery or characteristics associated with Nazism without reasonable excuse and in public. Nazi symbols are already banned in New South Wales, but the amendments will extend to the use of Nazi chants or slogans.
It is a recognition that the police are in an incredibly difficult situation. I mean, we have free speech in Australia, but obviously if it begins to tumble into hate speech or there's naked displays of fascism, anti-Semitism, neo-Nazis on our streets, then we want and expect civil society to take action. Now, police have to make that decision, and these are often finely balanced decisions in real time.
Under the reforms, anyone publicly supporting Nazi ideology could face up to a year in prison or a maximum fine of $11,000. Those penalties double for anyone committing the offence near a synagogue, Jewish school, or the Sydney Jewish Museum. In a statement, the president of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, David Ossip, said, "We wholeheartedly welcome the New South Wales government's proposed amendments." Dr. Kaz Ross is an independent researcher into far-right extremism. She argues clearer distinctions need to be made, saying police are taking different approaches in different states and territories.
We've got a bit of confusion in this country about what's offensive, what's legal and what's illegal.
I think there's an issue with the expressing support for Nazi ideology. That's when the argument will come back, well, what about free speech? How do we determine what is support for Nazi ideology and what is protected under free speech?
How do you think governments best go about addressing this sort of ambiguity?
That is an extremely good question. I think one thing we need to do is look at the existing laws and how they can be better used. The hate crimes, racial and religious vilification laws can be used. I've seen the move on orders issued successfully.
Dr. Kaz Ross says there's also a role for the federal government to play.
I definitely think that it's up to the federal government to start working out what counts as a Nazi symbol and to make sure that the legislation incorporates not just symbols that the Nazis in the 1940s, 30s and 40s used, but also the symbols that contemporary Nazis use today. Of course, the problem is that they can always come up with new symbols, and this is where we need a flexible legislation to include any new symbols or modifications that they might come up with. It would be extremely helpful if there was federal guidance on what is a Nazi symbol, what is a Nazi gesture.
The federal government this week revoked the visa of South African man Matthew Groote. He's being held in immigration detention after he was identified as one of the attendees at the National Socialist Network protest held outside New South Wales Parliament. The Home Affairs Minister is Tony Burke.
This bloke, for whatever reason, has decided that he can arrive in Australia and then tell a whole lot of Australian citizens that they're not welcome here. Well, the person who's not welcome is him, and he can leave.
And when it comes to legislative reforms on the federal level.
At the moment, there's significant powers we have under current law, but as you'd expect, there are conversations that I'm having with my department to make sure that all the laws that we have are fit for purpose, not only with my department, but obviously the different intelligence and law enforcement and security agencies that are within my portfolio as well.
The Home Affairs Minister, Tony Burke, Tania Dendrinos reporting. In Queensland, the inquiry into the operation of the construction union, the CFMEU, has heard allegations that a campaign of violence and intimidation was directed towards members of other unions in the pursuit of industrial power. Barrister Geoffrey Watson SC wrote a report on violence within the union's Queensland division. He's told the inquiry he believes Queensland union officials were emulating the campaign carried out on construction sites in Victoria, and he's cast doubt on the ability of Olympics organisers to build major infrastructure projects if the CFMEU retains control of the building industry. Rachel Mealy filed this report.
In April last year, the CFMEU formed a picket line on the site of the Cross River Rail, a major Brisbane infrastructure project, where non-unionised or workers from another union tried to enter the workplace, a violent altercation broke out.
People would have noticed this was incredibly dangerous. There were cars speeding down the road around about, 5 metres from where that brawl was occurring. This could have been led to a loss of life, this.
That's Barrister Geoffrey Watson, whose report about the violence in the CFMEU's Queensland division sparked Queensland's Commission of Inquiry. He says the control exercised by the CFMEU over the industry wasn't in his original terms of reference, but soon became apparent.
I was asked to look into violence in Queensland, so I didn't dig deeply into that, and probably the digging that I was doing fell outside my terms of reference. But you can't help but notice these things. And it also tells you something about the effectiveness of these campaigns.
The campaigns he refers to are campaigns of intimidation and violence run by CFMEU officials to scare other workers. He told the inquiry what was happening in Queensland emulated what had taken place in Victoria under former union boss John Setka.
Because if you knock out, this is what's happened in Victoria, if you knock out the AWU, you know what you're knocking out? The competition. So all of a sudden is one union with all the power and all of the negotiating tools and skills in an environment where labour is scarce because of the big build in Victoria or all of the massive infrastructure projects here. If you've only got one union covering all of these areas, they're given far, far too much power in those negotiations.
He says he can see that the intimidation tactics of the CFMEU have already driven away big construction companies from Brisbane's CBD, who see it as too much trouble to deal with the CFMEU.
Have a look around and you won't see the same names that you see in the other CBDs. Why? Because John Holland, I believe, is one, but other big name builders could see what was happening and they'd been burnt in Victoria. And you'll find that a lot of them are still heavily represented as major construction companies on projects on the Gold Coast in civil work and have avoided the Brisbane CBD construction market because of it.
Geoffrey Watson told the inquiry the control exercised by the union has a knock-on effect for the wider economy.
I mean, it's like any market. If there's a competition, you're going to get higher prices. Now, that's very good for the workers, the individual workers who are collecting it. And by the way, I respect them. They're working in hard, hot environments. But the point is, it's whether or not it's economically sustainable.
And it has major implications for Brisbane's ability to host the Olympics in 2032.
You can imagine the pressure that's about to be placed on scarce labour resources here with the Olympics coming along.
That's Barrister Geoffrey Watson, SC, giving evidence to the Queensland inquiry into the CFMEU. Rachel Mealy reporting. Well, generations of Australians have fond memories of playing sport as kids, but a new survey shows nearly a third of us believe the rising cost of living is making it harder for children to participate. The report comes from a charity called Good 360, which provides sport and play equipment to communities in need. Elizabeth Cramsey prepared this report.
It's an overcast day at Brisbane's South Bank, and those too young for school are giving the slide and swings a workout. But parents here are concerned. As their kids get older, they might not have access to sports and activities.
I find it hard to do when it's, say, $30 a class, three kids, $90 a week. Then there's, I guess, like time commitments, but the cost is definitely a factor. When trying to get them all to do an activity once a week.
This mum of three says while her family will prioritise sport, there might have to be a compromise.
Most places kind of don't really do like family packages or anything, so there's kind of no help or incentive to kind of get your whole family into like an activity together.
She's not the only one.
The electricity is through the roof. And then you got the mortgage repayments, car repayments, daycare. It's really tight.
Good 360 is a charity that takes new products donated by businesses and distributes them to charities, communities and individuals in need. Susan Wallace is the organisation's head of government and philanthropy.
We know that over $4 million of brand new goods go to waste in Australia every year, and that includes play essentials. And it's quite criminal that it's going to waste before having a first life in the hands of people in need.
The charity has researched what it calls play poverty, which is where people have been unable to afford items for their family to participate in sport or other outdoor activities. Its new survey shows play poverty is affecting 1 in 7 Australians, and sports clubs are also seeing the impact.
If you've got 2 or 3 kids playing soccer in this particular time, you know, it's difficult to buy a $100 pair of shoes.
In Ipswich, southwest of Brisbane, Jason Button runs a not-for-profit called Ipswich Assist.
These were shoes that were 2 sizes, 3 sizes too big that they might have found at a second-hand store or whatever, or they were a hand-me-down shoe.
Good 360 helped Jason Button link up with a business that had around 100 pairs of footy boots to donate.
You know, we even helped one young guy out who was representing Queensland. His parents couldn't afford to buy him new cricket spikes, and there happened to be a size 10.5 pair of cricket spikes come in from Good 360 in that same load. So we're able to give him a pair of those shoes and, you know, he's gone on to do great things in cricket.
And experts say the importance of playing in a child's development is underestimated. Catherine Daly is an occupational therapist.
It's the primary occupation of children and it's important for their health and their well-being, for their mental health and well-being, their physical capacity to develop and to learn. to play out conflicts and to create meaning. It's an, you know, it's an essential skill that we kind of undervalue the importance of.
Back at the park, this mum is thinking about sacrifices that could ensure her little boy can start AFL.
I'd definitely give up my personal things for them to play sport because you want that team. And I think keeping them busy and keeping them active is really important.
A Brisbane mother speaking to our reporter, Elizabeth Cramsey. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump resisted it for so long, but after a massive U-turn earlier this week, the remaining Epstein files are set to be released. The US House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted in favour of a bill to force the release of the documents. Today, David A. Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, on how Trump was backed into a corner. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.